This is Digital Story Podcast number 1066, August 25th, 2026. Today's theme is Camping Out with the Sony RX10 Mark V, a field review. I'm Derek Story. My short checklist for last week's camp out was tent, check, food, check, Sony RX10, check. I wanted to see if just one camera with one impressive zoom lens could capture everything I wanted during the trip. I was surprised by its performance, and that's what I'm going to talk about, along with the news, on this week's TVS Photography Podcast. I hope you enjoy the show. Camping out in the Redwoods, combined with a beautiful hike to the Pacific Ocean, provided the varied environment for putting the Sony RX10 Mark V through its paces. Outdoor life builds a pretty good argument for choosing the RX10. Its 24-600mm Zeiss f2.4-4 zoom lens provides a lot of optical power. For the 20-megapixel, 1-inch BSI CMOS sensor, that's powered by the Bion's XR processing engine with AI chip. This means I could capture shady landscape shots in the Redwoods, then zoom the lens for coastline life along the Pacific Ocean. All of this horsepower fits into a mid-size low-pro photoactive TLZ45AW top-loader camera bag with room to spare, slung over my shoulder and not slowing me down on the hike. In other words, just one camera, one lens for the entire trip. So let's get into just a few more specs, and then I'm going to tell you how the camera performed when I was in the field, what I liked, and a few things that I put in the suggestions category. But let's start out with some of the basic specs here. You already got that it's a 1-inch sensor, 20 megapixel. It's got a crazy zoom lens, 24-600mm. It's pretty wild, isn't it? It also has a 3.69 million dot OLED electronic viewfinder. Has a 3-inch 1.62 million dot tilting touchscreen LCD. 30 frames per second continuous shooting. AI-powered autofocus and subject tracking. 4K 60 full pixel 422 10-bit video. So there's a few more of the basic specs there. And then we'll talk about individual specs and how they played out in the field as I meander through this review. When I first unboxed the camera, it felt bigger and heavier than I expected. Now, I shouldn't have been surprised by this in the sense that I had been using the Panasonic FZ300 as my bridge camera, which has the same reach but a smaller sensor than the RX10. So bigger sensor requires bigger everything else. And that really plays out if you hold the FZ300 in one hand and the RX10 in the other. There's a sizable weight difference between the two, and also the size of the actual cameras, especially the size of the zoom lens. But we have to keep things in perspective here. This is also the only camera and lens that you're carrying. Period. The RX10 weighs 2 pounds total, and it measures 5.4 inches by 3.7 inches by 6 inches. So as I carried it up the hills and across the valleys, I wasn't thinking about its heft at all. What I was happy about was the 24-600mm Zeiss lens with a maximum aperture of f2.4. Now, one thing I will say in terms of differences comparing it to the FZ300 is that I wanted to carry the Sony in a top loader bag slung over my shoulder. And there were two reasons for this. One is because that 2 pound weight around my neck over the course of the day did add up a bit, and I was more comfortable carrying it crossways in a top loader bag. Now that's the only thing that was in that bag, right? Because, you know, it's a complete package. But I was more comfortable carrying it that way. And then the second reason is, and again, this is comparing it to the FZ300 or even the Panasonic L10 is that the flip up and down LCD viewfinder has the screen exposed on the Sony. And I'm always a little nervous about having that camera bouncing against my shirt with buttons and stuff like that on it because the screen is exposed. It's not fully articulated like the other two cameras I mentioned. And when they're fully articulated, I can fold the screen back against the camera body. And so then the screen isn't bouncing against my chest. It's the back of the screen that is. For those two reasons, I was really more comfortable carrying it in a top loader bag as opposed to just having it around my neck. Probably the one thing that you're thinking about right now is, what about the pictures themselves? Well, most of my shots on the camping trip were between ISO 100 and 800, and they were beautiful. They really were. The color was great. The noise was well controlled at those ISO ratings. Details were crisp. Great looking shots, both on the LCD for the camera and on my laptop. And I did fire them up on the laptop in camp. So when I would go out shooting in the morning, you know, fix breakfast and do all that sort of stuff, and then pack up and go for the hike, and had very little with me, just the camera and a few basic essentials. And then it would come back about 1 o'clock or so, have lunch, and then set up the field office and load the pictures and do some basic culling, a little bit of processing just to get a feel for how the camera was shooting while I was still in the field, just in case there was something that I wanted to reshoot or look at closer or, you know, try something different. Then I was able to do that, having reviewed the shots while I was still in camp. Between ISO 800 and 1600, which I didn't shoot at as much, I didn't need to because I was in pretty good light most of the time, the image quality was still quite good. There was a little noise, but in my shots it was mild. Once I got beyond ISO 1600, probably most discriminating photographers would probably want some noise reduction in post-production. This is where that smaller 1-inch sensor does come into play. And so it's bigger than the super small sensor in the FZ300, but smaller than the Micro Four Thirds sensor that I'm often shooting with in the field. So it's sort of in between the two. And that sensor, that 1-inch sensor, mainly because of the imaging pipeline that Sony has updated for the RX10, they get a lot out of that 1-inch sensor. And it's nice having that size of a sensor for a bridge camera because it does give you a little bit more latitude in terms of ISO and image quality. But it still has its limitations, of course. And I think people that will really notice the difference would be folks that normally shoot full frame, especially if you're shooting a full frame Sony, and then you have the bridge camera, let's say as a backup, or you just want to go for a hike and just, you know, take something that's more compact. When you're doing post-processing, if you're used to shooting with a full frame Sony, you will notice the difference with the 1-inch sensor, especially as the ISO goes up. It's funny, I went shooting after I got back from the camping trip. I went shooting at an outside event in Alameda called Demo Days. And mainly I went there to see the Slate, the new Slate Crook. It's been making the news lately. It's going to go into production here in about a month or two. And the Slate truck is interesting. It's a DIY sort of thing. It comes off the line as a basic truck. It's a small pickup. Made in the U.S., designed in the U.S., everything's U.S. about it, but you can work on it yourself. Like the panels come off because all the hardware is removable and adjustable and all that kind of stuff. You can do a lot to it. So I wanted to see this little electric pickup, and Demo Days provided me with that opportunity, but also there's a lot of other stuff going on there, you know. Rivian was there, Toyota was there, Outdoor Camping Gear was there, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so I took the Panasonic L10 for that event because it was more of a natural fit for covering an event like that. And I did notice a difference between the Micro Four Thirds sensor and the 1-inch sensor in the Sony. And they're both new release cameras. They both have the latest imaging pipeline that, you know, each brand has to offer and all that kind of stuff. So there is a noticeable difference. But the thing is, I don't think it's anything worth getting hung up on, that 1-inch sensor. I think it's something more to be thankful for, that you can have a camera that goes 24 to 600 millimeters and still get that good of image quality out of it in a 2-pound package. And that's the way that I'm looking at that 1-inch sensor. Let's talk about some pros and cons after using it for an entire trip. And by the way, when I was camping and hiking, I only brought this camera. So this was it. I was going to live or die. So if something spectacular happened, this was the camera I was capturing it with. So let's get to the pros first. I love the aperture ring on that Zeiss zoom lens. It's big, it's easy to use, and for those of us that really like shooting in aperture priority, it's a joy. Plus, they did this clever little thing. They have a switch on the bottom of the lens that allows you to turn on or off the click stops for the aperture settings. So if you're doing video work and you want, you know, non-clicking while you're changing aperture, while you're recording, you can turn it off. And then for those of us who like the click stops for still photography, you can leave it on. I thought it was really a cool feature, and I love it that it's a manual switch on the bottom of the zoom lens. I also want to mention that 3,680,000 dot electronic viewfinder is terrific. It's super wonderful to work with in the field. It's clear, it's bright, it's sharp, has a really nice diopter setting. Good stuff. And I think for field work, for me, it's super important to have a good electronic viewfinder, because you're in these bright conditions, you've got sun coming in from all different angles, all that sort of stuff. And it's a joy having an electronic viewfinder that's this good, not only for composing the shots, but also for reviewing them. You know, when you're in bright sunlight, I think it's much easier for me to review the shots through the electronic viewfinder than trying to do it on the LCD screen. The control dials and the buttons, they're well placed. They're easy to program. Very nice to use. Exposure compensation, you know, I have a dial for that. It's very important to me with a mirrorless camera. I got the buttons programmed the way that I wanted, all that kind of stuff. And once I got it set up, I thought the camera was really easy to use in the field and fairly intuitive. The large hand grip really makes it easy to hold the camera steady. This has a nice big grip on it. It has a fairly heavy front zoom lens, you know, so you need a grip or it's going to pull that nose down, especially as you zoom out. But I will say that the grip is super comfortable and I like it a lot. And you don't need to get an additional grip or anything like that for this camera. How it's designed is how you're probably going to use it, and that's nice. This is another thing you don't have to buy. The optical image stabilization, it works well, but you still need to get your shutter speed up for those 400 to 600 millimeter shots. You can't just depend on the optical image stabilization when you rack out that lens past 400. And when I get to the nits, there's a little bit of, I think, a shortcoming with the camera around this, and I'll cover that in a minute. But the main thing right now is optical image stabilization is good to a point. If you're an OM system shooter and you have that sensor-based stabilization and then you have a long lens on there and then it has optical stabilization and the two are working together, you're going to be a little spoiled and you're going to have to, you know, dial it back a bit. Working with this camera, the stabilization isn't quite as powerful as it is with the scenario I just described with OM system. But once you know its limitations, then you can, you know, make accommodations for it. This camera includes HEIF format, which I think is really important, because the JPEGs were good out of the camera, but their file sizes were a little bit big and they weren't very editable. Now, of course, I'm not looking for a JPEG to edit like a RAW file. That's not my expectation at all. But I do think I want to be able to make some basic exposure adjustments and not have the thing get gray. And I didn't think these JPEGs edited, you know, as well as I wanted Fortunately, though, and this is a good thing, that they have HEIF, the RX-10 has HEIF format option, and they actually have two of them. They have HEIF 420 and 422. I chose 420 and used that instead of the JPEGs. I shot with the JPEGs first, and then I switched to 420, and I liked it. I was wondering, well, is this going to be proprietary in any way? You know, can I only open it with Sony software? You know, all that sort of stuff. Because it does give you a little warning when you switch to HEIF about stuff like that, that it might not be compatible across the board, so to speak. However, the HEIFs opened great in Nitro. They opened great in Photos for macOS. So I'm assuming that they're going to open, you know, just about everywhere. The file sizes were much smaller than the JPEGs, but the image quality I thought was better and they were more editable. So I'm just going to shoot with this camera in the HEIF 420 format and just bypass the JPEGs. It was interesting when I was looking at the metadata in Nitro for the JPEGs, it said something like, you know, because Nitro really gets into the weeds with the metadata. It said something like old style JPEG compression when it was talking about the JPEG format for the RX-10. I was going, you know what? That kind of feels like what I was experiencing on the laptop with the JPEGs. Again, they came out of the camera looking fantastic. They look really good. It's just that if you want to do a little messing around with them, I would definitely go with the HEIF instead. I would just go with the HEIFs anyway. More quality, smaller files, easier to edit. Sony includes some really nice creative looks, and I like them a lot. They're sort of Sony's version of the picture profiles. Two I especially liked were the black and white, which I thought was an excellent profile. But it also has film profiles, and the film one, the FM1 film profile, I thought it was gorgeous. I really liked it, and it felt very much like a film shot. It really did, and I have some comparisons. I'm going to do an article on LiveView, and I'll run some of these different looks that Sony provides. The creative looks were quite nice, and I liked them so much that I set it up on the camera so I could switch among them easily with the outside buttons. It was a real plus. That was one of the pleasant surprises. Good close-up performance at the 24mm end and 600mm end, so you can get tight on elements. And I have some nice close-up shots of flowers and stuff that I really like that I took with this camera. And the NP-FZ100 rechargeable lithium ion 7.2 volt 2280 mAh. Battery rated for 630 shots is a nice upgrade. That means that you put the battery in the camera, if it's fully charged, you're going to be able to shoot all day with it. And I love it. And when it's time to charge it, just use a USB-C cord and you can charge it in camera. As you would suspect, there's no external charger included in the kit. All right, I do have a few cons. First of all, there's no built-in flash. And it seems like with a body this size, there would be room for that to be integrated. And again, I'm thinking, you know, this is all in one. I mean, the battery lasts all day. I've got this crazy zoom lens. The image quality is good enough to where I don't need another camera if I don't want it. Why not just put a flash in so I could have a little bit of fill light when I'm doing, you know, certain types of shots, you know, people shots or flower shots or whatever. So I think that's a miss. I wish they would have included that so I didn't have to carry one with me if I wanted to use a flash. The tilting 3-inch touchscreen LCD is nice. It's very nice. You know, as I said, it's got 1,620,000 dots. But I really do prefer the fully articulated LCD that can be folded with the screen against the camera body for protection. I'm a lot more comfortable with that sort of configuration if I have the camera around my neck, so I don't have to worry about the screen getting scratched by anything I may have in my pockets or buttons or that kind of thing. That's just a personal preference, but I'm still going to mention it because probably some other people feel the same way. If you're not already a Sony shooter, the menus are going to take some getting used to. It's just the way it is. One thing that I do when I do find something that I've been looking for a bit in the menu system, I save it to my favorites menu. That way I won't have to go hunting for it again. It's really helpful, especially in the early days of getting to know the menu system, to build up your favorites area to have the stuff that you know you're going to want, so you don't have to go searching for it in the field. I hear people complain about the menu system for the OM system all the time. So Sony OM system, I think most people complain about most menu systems, actually. When you have a camera that does so much, as these cameras do, you have so many menu items, it's probably quite the challenge to design a UI that is easy to use for photographers. Just be prepared, if you're not used to shooting Sony, to have to spend some time learning it. And then one of my surprises was when I was shooting with auto ISO on, and I had it auto 100 to ISO 3200, which this camera can handle that range just fine. But the camera didn't increase the ISO setting when it was in auto ISO for faster shutter speeds when I zoomed out to like 600 millimeters. There was one shot in particular where I saw these kayaks going down the river. I was up on a hill, so it's pretty far away, and I noticed that each kayak had a dog on it. It was super adorable. And this was a moment when I was going, man, I'm really glad I have this 600 millimeter lens. So I zoomed it all the way out. I was in aperture priority mode with auto ISO. And the aperture was only something like F4 or F5.6, somewhere in there. And I just shot, you know, because it was like a moment. I didn't have time to fool around with settings and stuff. So when I got back into field camp and I was reviewing the shots on the laptop, they weren't quite as sharp as I wanted them to be. And I wasn't going to blame it on the lens, because I don't think it was the lens per se. But when I looked at the metadata, so here I was at 600 millimeters, auto ISO, and the shutter speed was only 1/250th of a second. And the ISO was only 400. So I would think at 600 millimeters, you'd want that shutter speed to be at least 1/500th of a second. I prefer 1/1000th of a second. You know, I prefer faster, especially, you know, I'm tracking some movement, not super fast movement, but I'm tracking some movement. And so my expectation would have been at auto ISO that that ISO goes up to, you know, 800 or 1250 or something like that, because that's within the range of my auto ISO setting, so that I would get a faster shutter speed than 1/250th of a second. So I was disappointed by that, and I made a mental note that if I know I'm going to use the long telephoto, 600 millimeters or whatever, it's probably better that I switch to manual ISO setting if I know I'm going to be needing it, and jack that up to, you know, around 1000 or 1250, which that 1-inch sensor can handle fine. I would rather deal with a little bit of image noise in post than a shot that isn't sharp. You know, given the choice between the two, I'm going to take that little bit of image noise, and it's not going to be a whole lot anyway. So that was a little bit of a bad surprise for me, that it held the ISO so low, 400, and the shutter speed at 1/250th, when it could have jacked that up quite a bit. And finally, the price tag itself is $2,298. You know, that's substantial. I know everything right now is more expensive than I expect it to be. You would think that I would stop being surprised by this point on all this stuff. But still, given everything that this camera is and can do and all that, I was thinking that the price tag of, let's say, $1,999 seems a bit more appropriate to me. $2,298, essentially $2,300. That's a premium price tag. It's a good camera, but it's not going, even though it's got the crazy zoom lens and all that, it's not going to replace your Fujifilm APS-C sensor camera, your Sony full frame camera, or even your OM system Micro Four Thirds camera, or your Panasonic Micro Four Thirds camera. It's not going to replace any of those. It's still a specialty camera, still a backup camera. It's still, when you just want, you know, one unit for a hike that you're going on, $2,300 for something that is going to be used that way is a bit steep. However, I will say that if you're okay with the price, and it's, you know, it's not horrible in today's pricing, then I think you will be satisfied with the camera, right? I do think you'll feel like it was worth it. Bottom line, first of all, it's great to have an updated long telephoto bridge camera available again. Thank you, Sony, so much for doing that. And the RX10 Mark V is a good one, really, seriously. Terrific image quality at moderate ISOs, excellent autofocusing, very snappy, nice handling, solid lens, plenty of modern features such as USB-C, wireless connectivity, subject detection, and a robust and updated imaging pipeline. So, you know, good stuff. It's a very modern camera in that sense. Now, I know some people have complained that, hey, well, it's the same sensor that was in the camera that was released 9 years ago. Yeah, well, the sensor is the sensor, right? But everything around the sensor is updated. And this is a different camera than the RX10 Mark IV, believe me. This is much more updated. Definitely, you'll feel it. If you have a Mark IV and you try out the Mark V, I think it won't take you long to see the improvement of the Mark V. Once you get used to the menu system and program those buttons and dials the way that you like, it's an easy camera to use, especially for those who prefer to shoot in aperture priority. It's got that great aperture priority, that f-stop ring around the lens that's very easy to use. There is a bit of a delay when you turn on the camera. It's a bit longer than I like. I was a little surprised by that. And it'd be wonderful to have a built-in flash, but those are relatively minor nits compared to what you get, which is a 2-pound imaging powerhouse that's a versatile tool, especially for outdoor adventure. And I think that's where this camera excels, is what I was doing, camping and hiking, being on the go. You can go all the way out to 600 millimeters, get a telephoto shot. You've got a wide 24 millimeter lens for landscape. The image quality is good. There's some creative stuff in there to play with. Very nice for something that just fits in one little top loader around your shoulder. And if you're okay with a $2,298 price tag and you want an all-in-one solution for hiking and camping, I think you will very much enjoy the RX10 Mark V. I have time to squeeze in a couple news stories here. The first one, speaking of Sony, Sony's sensor factory is back to full operation after a major earthquake. And this is an article, it's on petapixel.com. I have a link in the show notes. This is important not just for Sony cameras, but many of our cameras use their sensors. Last month, a 6.8 earthquake struck Kumamoto, Japan. It caused serious damage to multiple structures and forced the evacuation of Sony Semiconductor's facility, which is located in the region. Nearly a month later, the factory has returned to full operating capacity. So what Sony said shortly after the earthquake was operations at the manufacturing plant were halted after the earthquake on July 28th and remained suspended. Damage to the site's building and manufacturing lines were being evaluated. So they said that right after the earthquake. And then they followed up with no significant damage to buildings or facilities has been confirmed. So that was really good news. There were no casualties, which is even better news than all of that. But out of caution and for reasons that might be related to how manufacturing hardware operates, restarting the facility understandably takes time. So despite this, Sony was able to partially reopen the factory on August 4th. That said, it would take weeks to get the facility up and fully running. Now, that stage reopening appears to have been completed about on schedule, and the factory now reports that it has returned to normal operation. Everything is back in order. It's worth pointing out that the last time a major earthquake forced the closure of Sony's sensor plant, it caused a months-long delay that resulted in cascading supply chain issues for every camera brand that sourced its sensors from Sony Semiconductor. The fact that no machinery or building structures were damaged in the latest earthquake is likely why the factory was able to get up and running again so quickly. Still, it's likely that losing the facility entirely for a couple weeks and lacking full production capacity for nearly a month won't be without its effects. It might take longer than expected to get the Sony FX5 production up to meet the high pre-order demand, for example. Still, overall, good news, and as we know from previous earthquakes in Japan, this could have been a lot worse. And since we're having chip problems everywhere anyway, I'm glad to hear that the Sony factory wasn't down for too awfully long. I also want to note that Capture One Mobile 4.0 brings desktop-grade denoising and healing tools to iPhone and iPad. This is on DP Review. I have a link in the show notes. Haven't talked about Capture One Mobile for a while. Let's see what the latest is. Capture One has released version 4.0 of its mobile app as part of its August 2026 update, bringing four tools previously limited to desktop software to the iPhone and iPad. The release narrows the feature gap between the company's desktop and mobile apps, giving photographers more editing capabilities on the go. Enhanced Denoise is a standout addition to version 4. Like other noise reduction tools these days, it uses AI to reduce noise while, according to Capture One, preserving fine details. Capture One has also added Color Balance, its three-way color grading wheel that allows photographers to adjust the color balance of shadows, midtones, and highlights. It gives mobile users more tonal control than was previously available on the Capture One mobile app. Another highly requested feature is the Heal and Clone tool, which lets photographers remove distractions on mobile devices. This means retouching no longer needs to wait until you're back at the desktop. Capture One has also added keyword support. Photographers can now tag and organize images in the field, making it easier to find the images they need. Lastly, the Crop tool has been updated to follow the camera's orientation when shooting tethered or copying and applying adjustments. These tools are all welcome additions to the mobile version of Capture One, which has long lagged behind the desktop in features. Version 16.8.5 of the desktop app also sees some small updates, including the ability to pan with the middle mouse button and support for the OM system, OM3 Astro, and more. The updated versions are available now for iPhone, iPad, and desktop. I think having some of these powerful tools, especially Denoise, on the mobile app and having it work the way that you would expect it to, especially compared to the desktop. Again, when we're talking about smaller sensor cameras that are very helpful in the field, whether it's the very small sensor like on the FZ300, the 1-inch sensor that's on the RX10, or even sometimes Micro Four Thirds sensors that are, you know, pushed in very low light situations, being able to denoise on your iPad, wow, that is a nice thing, not having to bring the laptop just to do one or two features that you wish you could do in the field, but had to wait to get home to do it. I haven't tested this yet. I haven't tested the mobile app for a bit, but this looks like a very good update. I have a couple items for Virtual Camera Club news. First of all, listener reviews. I asked last week that if you listen to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or another aggregator, that if you'd be so kind to post a review because they hadn't been updated in a while. And there were a couple updated reviews. Thank you so much. I hope you're listening this week. Thank you so much for posting those reviews. Very nice and very helpful. Again, I'd like to have a few more updated reviews in addition to the couple that were posted last week. If you're using the Apple Podcasts app to listen to this, please take a minute to post a review. Let's get a handful, a nice handful, a big handful of updated reviews on there so people know that this podcast is alive and well. We know it is, but we want people that are considering listening to also know that is alive and well. And thanks again to those folks who did post reviews. Also want to mention that if you're going to buy new gear, for example, the Sony RX10 Mark V, I have affiliate tiles for both B&H Photo and Amazon on every page of the digital story. And the links that I put in the show notes for gear, for example, the Sony RX10, those are also affiliate links. If you would stop by the site first, especially if you're all ready to go because you listen to this podcast, and use those links or click on those tiles and then make your purchase, that does help support this podcast, and I truly appreciate it. Also want to acknowledge our Inner Circle members. These are the folks that support this podcast month in and month out. They do a great job not only supporting us financially, but also spiritually, and then providing feedback and just, I don't know, giving us a certain energy that I really enjoy. Thank you, Inner Circle members, for becoming so involved in this community. And if you want to join us, just click on the Patreon tile that's on all the pages of Digital Story, and you can sign up there. And the next thing you know, you'll be hearing from me, bringing you in to this wonderful community of artists. Thank you, Inner Circle members. Also, I have to acknowledge our good friends at Red River Paper, longest running sponsor of the Digital Story. I was thinking about when I was out in the field shooting, making prints from some of the shots from the RX10. And of course, you know, having that 20 megapixel resolution gives me enough to make a nice 11 by 14 print. And then I was thinking about what I talked about with Lightroom a couple weeks ago, you know, and being able, using the print module, to float those images on a nice piece of paper and not have to mat them and frame them. And I was just thinking that printing just is so much easier than it used to be. We have such good tools. We have such great paper. The printers are easier to use. And the barrier to entry for inkjet printing is much lower, much less than it used to be. And then we have the workshop coming up in November, which you can sign up for if you want to spend time with people who enjoy printing and get lots of tips that way as well. So the bottom line here is there's really no reason not to print. If you have a printer and you get yourself some Red River paper and experience the joy of creating real artwork that you can hand to other people. Big thanks to Red River Paper for supporting this community and the printers in it. They have a tile on all the pages of the Digital Story. Click on it, nose around a bit, get yourself some paper and start making artwork. Thank you, Red River Paper, for supporting us. All right, it's going to do it for me this week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Working on more great stuff for next week. Until then, get out there, take some pictures. See you next Tuesday. Bye-bye now.